Welcome to episode 50 of The Climate Champions, the final episode of 2019. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. This week was a first for the Climate Champions. It was recorded in front of a live audience at GridConnects in Washington, D.C., and it was a blast. My guest, Miguel Romero, is Vice President of Energy Supply at San Diego Gas and Electric, SDG&E. SDG&E lit its first lamp on San Diego streets in 1881. Today, SDG&E is an innovative San Diego-based electric and gas utility that is guided by its mission to improve lives and communities by building the cleanest, safest, and most reliable energy company in America. It provides safe and reliable clean energy to its 3.6 million consumers in San Diego and Southern Orange counties. Sempra Energy, where I worked for over 20 years, is the parent company of SDG&E. Sempra is a San Diego-based energy services holding company whose subsidiaries provide electricity, natural gas, and value-added products and services. If you want to get together with me in person to talk about Sempra, climate change mitigation, energy innovation, or just to grab a peaty scotch, join me at DistribuTech International, the leading annual transmission and distribution event that addresses technologies used to move electricity from the power plant through the transmission and distribution systems to the meter and inside the home. DistribuTech runs from January 28th to the 30th, and I'll be there the entire time, though admittedly, Wednesday I'll be pretty busy. I'll be hosting the New Business Models for Utilities Breakfast Roundtable, then moderating a mega session at 10 on how digital solutions are enabling a decarbonized grid, where Google and utilities will discuss decarbonization by leveraging the cloud. And then at 2, I'll be chairing a session on real-world microgrids, templates for the future, examining three distinct microgrid projects. And lastly, rumor has it, I'll be doing a live podcast on Thursday. More information on that as plans firm up. As Vice President of Energy Supply, Miguel oversees all aspects of acquiring energy and capacity to serve SDG&E customers, including electric generation and resource planning. Miguel joined Sempra Energy in 2004, with a majority of his time spent serving in various commercial development and management capacities, including renewable power origination for Sempra Renewables, where we met, and mergers and acquisitions for Sempra Energy, among other roles. Miguel holds a bachelor's degree in business administration from the University of San Diego and a master's degree in international affairs and management from the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to the Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and joining me today is Miguel Romero. He's the Vice President of Energy Supply at San Diego Gas and Electric, that's SDG&E. And I should also mention this is my first live in front of an audience podcast, so very excited about it. Miguel, with regards to climate change, what was your motivating moment when you decided you had to get engaged in doing something about it?
Well, thank you for having me, Lee. It's interesting, you know, we all end in our career sometimes by accident, right? And even though we try to align our work to our passions, it's always hard to do. But I think for me, I got lucky enough. When I started in working in the energy space, it wasn't in renewables. And I wasn't necessarily pursuing the energy industry, right? I landed on it. It was during the California energy crisis. It provided a good opportunity for me to learn. But as I got embedded in it throughout multiple roles in my career, I remember I got invited to work on the power side of the business. And at the time, an old officer, he asked me as he recruited me into the group that they were forming an origination role. He said, you know, back then we had a big portfolio of combined cycle gas power generation. And we were starting sort of to fiddle in the renewable space. And he asked me, right, he said, hey, I need to form an origination role for both the gas side and this crazy idea of renewables. Which one do you want? I remember I said, I'll get back to you. And I went back and consulted with my father, right, an advisor of mine always. And I said, hey, I got this opportunity to work on this new idea or the more established gas side of the business where the assets are already there and they're contracted and it's just, and he kind of advised me to, well, stick with the stuff that's already working, right?
And I just said no, right?
I wanted to play in the renewable space. And again, it was, right now it's easy to say, oh, it's an easy decision. But back then we were still thinking about it, right? And I did it because I was passionate about the environment. And I was passionate to, even though there was risk associated with it, also in the company we were in, it was heavily focused on gas at the time. I was taking on a risk, but I believed in renewables, and I wanted to make a difference, not just get paid to do something that was cool, but really make a difference, and it worked out.
Yeah, so. Doing something that you're passionate about versus just doing a job makes a big difference in how you feel every day.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about why it's personal to you?
That's a good question. It's personal because I believe in the environment, right? And I have kids, and I think we have as citizens a responsibility to make a difference in the planet we live in, right? We owe it to our fellow citizens, and we owe it to the new generations. I spend a lot of time, my older son is now 12 years old in middle school, but when he was in elementary school, I spent the time sometimes going back when he was in first grade and third grade, talking to the kids in his school, and leveraging my, it's sort of one of those dad come to school days, right? And I was leveraging my experience in renewables and talking about how solar work and how wind work, and brought these little toys and models, and just seeing how the kids reacted to it made a big difference for me, right? So I think for them, it'll take those new generations as they grow older and older to us making sure that we're making a difference. So this is why, you know, this is why we do it for them.
When you meet somebody that doesn't believe or doesn't understand the impact of carbon to climate change, how do you explain it to them? How do you get them to understand it?
It's hard. It's hard, right? I think, you know, number one, obviously we need to be respectful of everybody's different opinions. But it's hard because it's hard to point to, right? We talk about the science behind it, and you know, there's very simplified examples that we can point to and show, you know, the trends, you know, post the Industrial Revolution, how things have gotten worse and worse. But there's always the skeptics out there, right? Is this really true or not? And it's hard to combat, right? So I go back to, this is where I think the fact that pointing to the awareness that's occurring more and more is helpful in telling that story. But now, more than ever, we are seeing more intense and extreme weather events in all areas of the world, right? Whether it's more hurricanes or there's more intense and frequent fires because of more intense and frequent less humidity Santa Ana winds in our neck of the woods in California. That's something to point to, right? To those that are skeptic, I turn it back with a question, you know, what's happening there, right? And obviously you get the answers that, well, it's the planet, right? It's cyclical, it happens every 100 years. But it's getting easier and easier, I think, to tell that story.
Lately, when I've been referencing that Anchorage, Alaska was 90 degrees, that seems to raise eyebrows with everyone I talk to, regardless of what they believe, that they can get that is not where we should be.
Absolutely. I saw, you know, part of that telling that story, and I can't take credit for this comment I'm about to make, but I was seeing, there was this quick video in Al Jazeera, the publication, but it was in English, that one of the persons there explaining climate change said, why is it that when we go to the doctors and we get a diagnosis of something that's a severe illness, that it's very hard, that may not be symptomatic, right? We believe doctors and we go and take the medicines, right? And right now, you know, we have the evidence there, or somewhat of an evidence, and we're not believing it, right? So it's going to take that kind of mentality to be sure that we want to take the medicine to clean the planet up.
Some people don't take the medicine because they don't believe it. So there are people that don't believe doctors either.
Absolutely.
What do you do at SDG&E?
So I've been with the Sempra Energy family of companies for 15 years. My last tour of duty is with the utility SDG&E. Currently, I'm involved with the energy supply group, and we are in charge of managing the day-to-day supply portfolio, but at the same time transitioning it. But that supply portfolio that we talk about at SDG&E currently is roughly about 40-45% renewable power today, right? So it's something that also we're very proud of, delivering renewable goals above and beyond where the states needs us to be. And then previous to that, I've been involved with energy storage efforts as well, something that I've been passionate about, to see how that technology can enable more renewables in a cost-effective way, in a responsible way, beyond where we are today. And prior to that, I spent 10 years with one of the Sempra divisions that we've now transitioned out of, in building a large portfolio of renewables throughout the U.S. We build over 1,000 megawatts of solar and 1,000 megawatts of wind across the U.S., which, again, it's something that the collective team built, but it's something that I'm very proud of, and I constantly point to when I'm traveling with my kids over some of these assets that, hey, that's going to be there for 40 years, providing clean power, so we should all feel proud about it, regardless of who owns it.
That's when you and I met.
That's when you and I met.
We both work for Sempra Renewables.
Exactly.
Do you want to talk about some setbacks that you've had?
Not necessarily. I don't think I've necessarily seen setbacks. It's been an evolving effort. It's been an evolving transition. I think if I would answer that question more broadly, I think we are going through some setbacks nationally, right? I think for those of us that believe in promoting clean policies, you know, no secret that federal government has taken different positions, different views on some of these initiatives. And that's a setback for the broader goal. But I think ultimately, I'm still very optimistic. It's hard to slow down an initiative and a movement that's necessary, and we're clearly seeing that throughout the world.
What I've heard from a lot of people that I've talked to is almost because the federal government pulled out, individual cities and states have taken up the charge, and maybe they're even doing more than they would have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Obviously, at some point, we've associated clean versus non-clean with certain aspects of politics, which I will not get into. But when I spend a lot of time in my origination days traveling throughout all the states, all types of states that were building renewables for one reason or another, you could see that they were doing it because it made sense, right? It would make sense economically, it made sense for the environment, and even states that you would think would be in a different side of the political debate, they were still moving forward with it. And I remember the days when the Clean Power Plan Act came about, and you know, obviously some states were even suing the federal government at the time. But nonetheless, they still wanted to have the discussions on how they were ultimately going to transition, because they saw it as a responsible and cost-effective way to do so. So I think when those stars aligned, it's hard to debate.
How about success? What success are you most proud of?
I think from a success standpoint, aside from building all these different renewable power plants throughout the nation, I think what I got the most happiness about is when we, you know, a lot of these assets are built in very remote places across the country, right? And
there's this picture of windmills above the clouds, taking it from above the cloud perspective. That's a phenomenal picture. You know what I'm talking about?
Pennsylvania, Mahoopany.
Yeah.
Exactly. So some of these assets support communities as well. You know, a lot of our fellow developers out there can have experienced this, right? When you go in, and you know, there were other areas also in the western part of the U.S., desert communities where we brought in a lot of solar, 500 plus megawatts in certain regions progressively, and in utilizing land assets, either private land or sometimes city-owned land that provided leasing revenues. As we've developed stronger relationships with those communities that were hosting those assets we were developing, to me, that's where I got the most joy of, is seeing how these communities got improved by obviously the leasing revenues that came in, but also the engagement that was there. And, you know, we got very involved with the communities. And to this date, even if we've divested some of these assets, those relationships are still there. And then the communities that are community leaders in some of these small towns, very supportive of great people that embraced renewables and embraced these types of investments, not because it brought money, but because they ended up being firm believers of renewables. That was very gratifying to see.
I heard that in some of those areas, initially, they weren't excited, but by the end, they were.
Absolutely. I think it explains sort of the fear of not knowing what it means, right? Obviously, you see big corporations come in, and there's that fear of what does this mean for me? But as they see that some of these assets are really making a difference, and they can continue on with the same ways of life, and in some aspects, you know, more so for the wind areas where they can continue, you know, raising cattle around the wind farms. Yeah, very supportive and very happy about and very proud about seeing wind farms. And actually, sometimes when we're talking to individual landowners, not necessarily city-owned land, you know, initially, as you were pointing out, it was that collectiveness of multitude of landowners that you needed to bring together to form a project. And sometimes people opted out, not in my backyard, right? But once they saw the others getting the business, everybody wanted to jump in and be part of that as well. So
I interviewed somebody named Pip Decker, who is a wind developer. He also does solar, but a wind developer. And he talked about how he would put people in buses that were upset and take them to completed projects, right, to give them a vision.
Right.
of what it could look like.
We did the same similar things, right? I think to me, obviously in that whole development cycle too, the part I enjoyed the most too was just going out there and seeing the sites. Obviously people also debate whether there's a visual aspect of it or noise aspect of it. You know, we can't have it both ways, right? But I think at the end of the day, knowing that you're doing something that's good for the environment, it comes together.
Speaking about vision, what is your vision for the future? Where do you see California, since you're there, the U.S., since we're here, and the world over the next 20, 30, 40 years?
More renewables. No, I think it ties well to all the discussions we're having about how is the ultimate future distribution grid going to look like, right? I do see, for just hypothetical standpoints, there are futures out there where we can expect more distributed energy resource, you know, more behind-the-meter resources, more renewables with energy storage, and all these types of things, more electrification, right? And all of them interacting around a common goal is about decarbonizing the economy, right? So I think that future, we'll have to figure out how it all comes together, but it's not far-fetched. I know you're saying 20, 30 years. I'm not going to put a number to it, but maybe there is a future, where we're really tapping into that benefit of a free renewable resource, right? Obviously, there's a capital investment that goes with it at the beginning, where we're getting free power. It's not going to be zero cost to consumers, right? Because we still have to deliver the power, but at least from a commodity standpoint, it's not far-fetched to think that ultimately, at the end of the day, we're going to have that free power. In today's day and age, you talk about California, right? No secret that we're curtailing a lot of renewable energy in the middle of the day because we have so much solar that we don't have the load for, right? And we have those famous duck curves that you've heard about where prices go negative. Still cheaper today to curtail than it is to build energy storage to capture it. But I'm very encouraged about how energy storage is continuing to drop. So not far-fetched to think that, you know, once those costs get to a point, we will not have to curtail, and we can then shift all of that energy that we are curtailing. And yes, now you're around the clock finding ways to deliver power in a very inexpensive way or close to zero.
You did not like my timeline of 20, 30, 40 years. But I will ask you this. Do you think the human race will act fast enough to not have the largest impacts hit us?
So I'll answer your question in a different way. That was the what technologies are going to be available 20, 30 years. But yes, how is the environment going to look 20, 30 years from now? I'm concerned about that. I think we've seen, and I'm pointing to the scientists, right, that we're concerned about the temperature of the Earth rising, and the UN and all the committees that are associated with these studies suggest that we can get up to 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees. But I think that the concern is how fast it's occurring, right? And they weren't expecting it to happen as fast as they thought. So that is my concern, that I think all these weather events that we're talking about, you know, there's more and more people in the Earth. Will it get to a level that is just too intense for us to handle in the short term, right? And how are we going to react to that, right?
It concerns me, if you've listened to any of my podcasts. Do you have any questions for me?
No secret, we've worked together in the past, and I'm very happy to see that you're also, as you're interviewing a lot of climate champions throughout your podcast, I consider you a climate champion, right? So I'm curious to see what are your plans, obviously, continuing with these efforts, and are you eventually going to stop? Which I hope the answer is no.
I don't think I'm going to stop being a climate champion. With regards to the podcast, it would be good to find a way to monetize it. I have not focused on that at all. And not focusing on monetization means you don't monetize. That's what I've learned. I've actually had two companies approach me, but in both cases, there was some amount of control they wanted with regards to guests and the type of ads I'd have that I wasn't completely comfortable with. So at some point, I do need to make some money, so I might have to maybe go to once every other week or once a month. Right now, I'm doing this every week, and that takes up at least half my time each week, scheduling the interviews, going to the interviews, and then editing them as well.
Well, good. We'll keep going.
But I'll find some way to contribute, no matter what happens. Is there anything else that you want to say that you weren't able to get out?
Yeah, I think definitely my area of expertise and my area of focus has been on the energy supply side of things, right? And how the power generation sector contributes to greenhouse gas emissions or not within California. And it's different for every state in the U.S., different across the globe. But for in California, we're not where we are now. Obviously, the portfolio doesn't involve coal. We have a lot of renewables deployed now, and a lot of the rest it comes from natural gas. But we're roughly, I think it was, 10, 15% of contribution to GHG in previous years. But it's the transportation sector and the industrial sector that shouldn't be forgotten, right? I think as we think of an ultimate climate goals, we seriously need to focus on those two sectors. Yes, it's easy for us to get the legislation and the regulations to do more renewables, which I welcome every single day, and we will continue to do that and make sure that we make those assets more efficient and more effective and leverage the stuff we already deployed so they continue producing more. I was mentioning with storage. But it's the other two sectors that we can't forget, right? I think in the transportation sector is light-duty vehicles, and we are seeing pushes in California to do more of that. But it'll take time. We know it'll take time. It's not easy for folks as end consumers to easily adopt and change cars every year just because they're there, right? So, but there needs to be a push in that sector and in the industrial sector, noting that there is heavy industry that not easy to simply electrify it and fuel it with renewables, right? Because it involves heating aspects of it that may require more traditional fossil fuels. But it'll take all sectors, all economic sectors, in immediate action today. And also beyond the sectors, it's an international effort, right? As we know, and you know what the U.S. did in separating itself from some of these sort of light agreements. You know, obviously the Paris Agreement is sort of an agreement to do stuff, right? But not necessarily a binding thing. You know, we need to push the envelope there. And even for those countries that stayed, no secret, China and Russia and others are putting very light goals in there. So how do we approach that sort of global focus? How do we approach that all sector focus? And to the extent there are subsidies, you know, not be afraid to make those subsidies international to some extent, right? But we need to lead by example. So I think we need to spend a lot of time focusing on what the next step should be.
I recently had a guest who made me think about food as well, and how much climate change and carbon is associated with food. And it's significant, and there are ways to do something about that, but I think that is even more of a challenge than what we've talked about here.
Absolutely. I think as we hear the science behind what creates climate change, right, what are the key sources of GHG emissions, you know, that topic, which I am not an expert on, but I've heard it mentioned too, is, you know, the meat eating industry, right? And even though I don't eat a lot of meat myself, but it's the fact that just think behind what goes into cattle raising and, you know, also the GHG aspects of doing all that. There is a whole thesis on it. I know, you know, I could never stop eating jamón serrano, so
I don't know. Actually,
but there is something to it. So I think yes, if there's a responsibility and we need to make lifestyle changes, then I'll be the first one.
It's a lower percentage of the problem, but I think it's the hardest to solve is what we eat.
Right. And it ties to that whole, you know, population growth, right? It's happening exponentially, and what are the impacts of such exponential growth? And you know, to me, my optimistic side I think we will figure it out, you know, and I'm always trustworthy of how technology has evolved in the past, and it's solved other problems we've had in the past. So I'm a firm believer of that, but it comes from awareness, having awareness first, right? If you just think technology is going to solve it, I'm not going to worry about it. No, it's that you worry about it, you create the awareness, and that worrying will create that technology innovation and evolution, and you have the right incentives in place.
Before I go on, I think this is a great opportunity to take questions from our live audience. Does anybody have any questions?
Got one over there.
All right. First question. Yes, sir.
With all of the movement toward 50% or more renewables and distributed energy resources, the way that suppliers get paid in the future and customers pay for electricity or whatever services, I think our traditional rate designs are not sustainable. There's a lot of concern about subsidies from low-income customers to those who are putting solar panels on their homes. What do you see as sort of the principles for rate design in the future, moving sort of from a set rate to maybe more of a value-based? You know, what is the value of battery storage during a critical peak period? What are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, I think definitely rate design will need to change and evolve, right? And I think it'll take multiple iterations as we introduce some of these new technologies. Definitely always keeping in mind that one sector of a society or one sector of an industry cannot subsidize another. If we make it fair and equitable, and we should, that rate design will need to evolve to make sure that we're, one, allowing these technologies to come in a fair way, and two, again, we're not burdening people who should not be burdened. But second, I think we need to discuss, and I don't necessarily have a solution or a proposal, but as this social problem becomes worse and worse, you know, what does that ultimately mean, right? And not as ratepayers, but as taxpayers, as citizens, right? Does it merit more discussion at those levels, right? That we are now gonna have allocating part of our GDP or part of our local taxes or part of our state taxes to some of these mitigations, right? And throw those costs long-term so we are also not burdened tremendously. Where are those discussions and how are we gonna remedy some of these problems we have at a broader level?
Yes, another question.
Besides decarbonizing the energy sector and transportation sector, the evolving discussion is about reducing consumption, overall consumption. So one speaker yesterday at the COP asked the question, how many of you can live with just 2 suits and 4 shirts? Avoid buying a new shirt until your shirt is completely unusable. Teach your children not to buy new bags and shoes every month. So of course, this will have overall impact on the economy, but the evolving discussion is all around that. And also another person asked the audience, we all talk about avoiding single-use plastic. How many of you carry a cloth bag in your pocket when you go for shopping? There are very few hands that went up in the audience.
I think that's a very good point. I'll talk about the electric sector and then I'll talk about the broader sector. As we were mentioning about potential having a future where there's an abundance of renewable power, inexpensive or close to free renewable power, in a world that's electrified, that there's going to be more electric consumption, right? You could argue, you could see that, hey, well, who cares at that point, right? Let's just electrify everything and it'll just be, but I agree with you. I think even as we do all those things, we can never lose sight of conservation. I think those efforts that we've put in place on energy efficiency in the past, and they're continuing to evolve, and how do we use less energy, even if there were to be an abundant supply of renewable, needs to go right along with it, right? That sort of conservation effort, how do we make things more efficient, how we utilize less electricity, less power, will help get towards those clean goals a lot faster. And on the other one, it's not just about electric sector, recycling and everything else we've been doing is important as well. That's part of why I'm encouraged with the new generations. And I remember, as a kid growing up, I guess young in the 70s and 80s, we didn't have seatbelt rules, right? And I remember we all sat in the back of the car and no seatbelts. And I don't know how we all survived, right? But obviously less people, cars weren't as fast, less traffic. But I remember when seatbelt rules got started putting in place, and it took us time to kind of get the habit of it, and we were kind of annoyed that we had to even put it on, right? And now it's common habit, right? And then I saw it when I was seeing sort of those new generations, younger cousins I had, where they immediately were the ones that were advocating, hey, put the seatbelt on. And for them, it's a normal thing, right? And I see them also pushing for those recycling initiatives of young generations. And now, no secret, we all see the news, right? They're getting more and more involved in climate initiatives, right? So I hope that push will continue to drive us in the right direction. I just hope it happens quickly.
I think it's a good sign that we as a people have changed some things, even though I think this is going to be a lot more difficult than that. I interviewed Kevin Parker, state senator in New York, and he said the only way we're really going to get this is by educating the children, that adults are going to have too hard a time. Okay, so we're out of time. So with that, I'm going to wrap this up with a wrap. Here we go. So you had a chance to change your occupation. Your dad said no, but you went to Originations. You're trying to teach the kids with toys and models so they could understand it because you wanted them to help save the planet. If you want to convince others, you need good data and you better rehearse because the weather and everything else is getting worse and worse. You said that the federal government is giving us a setback, but you also think that the cities keep us on track. Can we eat less meat? Do we have the nerve? Can we have less shirts and suits? Can we conserve? Your VP of energy supply, you buy and you sell. Thank you very much, Miguel.
Mike out.
Thank you. Good job, buddy.
All right, thank you everybody for being at this experiment.
That's awesome, man. Thank you. That's cool.
It was-
was exciting recording my discussion with Miguel in front of a live audience. He did a great job. I thought the story of Miguel going to his father for advice about whether he should take the renewable job or not, coupled with our discussion about the next generation being more engaged on climate change, shined a light on the growing perspective and importance of the generation gap. This past weekend, my brother told me that my ideas were old. I was a little defensive. Okay, maybe a lot defensive at first, but I've been soul-searching and reevaluating my ideas since. My children are coming to visit for the holidays, and I'm going to spend a lot of time talking to them and trying to understand their perspective. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crivatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want to release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking an improv workshop at an improv club in your town. I'd like to dedicate this episode of The Climate Champions to Rich Nerzig. He's a good friend and colleague of mine and Miguel's who passed away last week. Rich was a wind developer, and the last time I talked to him, I invited him to be a guest on The Climate Champions, but he wanted to finish the major wind project he was working on first so that he'd have more to talk about. Rich was a true climate champion. Here are Rich's favorite words from a Cherokee Feast of Days found many years ago on a box of tea. This is the time to see the dearness of other people, the chance to be grateful, to enjoy. Why wait? Perfect times are elusive. They create an atmosphere that life should be lived on some high emotional level instead of experiencing the most ordinary times with the most extraordinary love. Time goes by. The peaks are not what made life worthwhile, but the in-between times that gave us a chance to stand in the quiet of a wooded glen, even if it is just in our hearts, and know that love made it worthwhile. Here's to Rich and Mapo Tofu at Spicy City, Miguel, and my old team at Semper Renewables, each in our own way, still helping to mitigate climate change.